But growing up here, I realized that I didn't know much about Edmonton. So I did elementary, junior high, high school here, but I didn't learn anything about Black history. To me, Black people were a new thing to Edmonton and Alberta. But in the past year, I came across some things that really blew my mind. How, you know, to put it simply, ever since white people have been here, Black people have also been here.
Hello and welcome to a podcast presentation of the Yards Fall 2018 issue launch and salon, recorded live at the offices of Alif Partners on Thursday, September 6th. I'm Jeff Samsonow, publisher of Edmonton Quotient, an online magazine here in the city, partnering with the Downtown and Oliver magazine to bring you this conversation. The fall issue of the Yards is focused on finding community and recognizing leaders of our past and present. Among the stories are those highlighting history of community leagues, neighborhood heroes, and the cover story about people missing from so many of our community and history conversations, often people of color and indigenous peoples. Pick up a copy of The Yards at all kinds of locations in the downtown and Oliver. Check out a listing at theyardsyeg.ca. You can also find the latest from the magazine at that website, theyardsyeg.ca. And if you live in one of those neighborhoods, you probably already received your copy by mail. For this issue launch, Yards publisher Simon Yakaluk sat down with the author of the cover story, Bashir Muhammad, to talk about his search for Lulu Anderson after he encountered her hidden or forgotten story from our downtown's past. We'll jump right into the conversation with Bashir and Simon, and please do keep listening through the audience questions, as there are plenty of great insights on what we deem important from our past and how we can or should memorialize and highlight it today and in the future.
Bashir's been doing some great work on bringing to light overlooked and unknown pieces of our city's history. So to kick it off tonight, Bashir, if you'd be able to just speak a little bit to what you encountered. So who was Lulu Anderson?
Hello. Oh, hi. So I guess to give some context about how this all started. So I came to Canada in 1997, and I was born in Kenya, but we came to Edmonton in February. So when we landed, my sister convinced me that snow was sugar. So I put it in my backpack, and it all melted. So that was my first experience with Edmonton. But growing up here, I realized that I didn't know much about Edmonton. So I did elementary, junior high, high school here, but I didn't learn anything about Black history. To me, Black people were a new thing to Edmonton and Alberta. But in the past year, I came across some things that really blew my mind. How, you know, to put it simply, ever since white people have been here, Black people have also been here. The first recorded Black person was a fur trader with Fort Edmonton. And there's a few other stories sprinkled through, but not a lot of it is really covered. So a lot of what I did is I went to the Peel Prairie Archive, which is a bunch of newspapers in Alberta that have been scanned, so you can search through them. And I just searched a bunch of slurs, because that's how they referred to Black people back then. And I found an article that said, colored woman suit theater, and this was like last year. And I thought it was interesting, so I dug a bit deeper and I found a few other articles that said color line confirmed. And I really wanted to know who this person was. All I had was her name, Lulu Anderson, the year it happened, and also the place it happened. It happened at the Metropolitan Theater, which was four blocks from here. It's the old Enbridge building. There used to be a theater there. And in 1922, May 12, she walked in to see the film, The Lion and the Mouse. Actually, that film is actually considered a lost film. So it's kind of funny how that works, because her case was destroyed, so her case is lost too. But she was forced out of the theater, and she sued the theater, and it was a six-month court case, and unfortunately, she lost her case. But this happened 20 years before Viola Desmond, 30 years before Rosa Parks in Edmonton, and we know very little about her.
I think this is one of the interesting ideas you bring up in your piece, too, that we don't know about this history, that this is there were comparable civil rights actions happening elsewhere that are very well known. Yeah. What's the impact on Edmonton and people in the city to not know this sort of history?
Right. Well, I mean, like, when bad things happen. So the reason why I was interested in this history at all was a few years ago, there was, like, this discussion happening nationally. I forget exactly what it was, but people were saying, we don't have this racist history here. Canada is different. And that, like, I didn't know if that was true or not. And I'm very stubborn, so I decided to find out if it was true. And turns out it wasn't. Like, Lulu Anderson, her lawyer's office was in the McLeod building. And one block away is where the KKK would have their headquarters in Edmonton, which was right behind the Westin. And the KKK actually influenced an election in 1931. They elected Daniel Knott as mayor, and he approved. You could see letters between the Klan and him approving cross burnings at Northlands and everything. If you want to see like a legacy, the 20s and 30s, black patients were not allowed into Edmonton hospitals. And in 1938, a black nurse applied for training at the Royal Alex Hospital, and she was denied entry. And if you look at nursing graduation photos at the U of A, all the way up till the 80s, you don't see a single black person. And that's from that legacy. So, like, to me, that's why that whole thing is important. And, like, it still has an effect on Edmonton.
One of the things Bashir talks about in this piece is how this history was almost erased in Edmonton. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Yeah. So, in Lulu's case, it was... My first step was to look for her court case, because court cases... Well, even nowadays, there's examinations, which are one-hour interviews with the defendant and the plaintiff. And, her court case was destroyed. The Alberta government destroyed court cases from, I think it was the 20s to the 40s in 1971. And the reason was records retention. So that's one reason. The other reason is just a lot of it wasn't documented. So, like, when it comes to Lulu's case, in all the articles, she's not quoted... She's not interviewed. So I actually never saw anything that was written by her or spoken by her. So their perspectives are often ignored. If you look at how black people were referred to back then, they're often referred to as the N-word and then their first name. They weren't given their full name. John Ware, for example, who was a famous black cowboy, when he passed away, the provincial government named a ridge after him, and they called it Nigger John Ridge. And that lasted until the 70s. So that's one reason. Or like, you know Gibson Block, which is just like down Jasper, it's the Flatiron, is that the name of the flat? Yeah. They had a sign on the back that said white help only. And that sign was there until the 90s. And they literally painted over it with white paint. So it was literally whitewashed. And you can see it if you like go by there.
I know that you're doing some research from not just this case, but some other cases as well. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that a bit and what that means for Alberta's history? I know you have that case in Calgary that you looked into that where he won.
Yeah, so Alberta has a long civil rights history. Charles Daniels in 1914, there's a theater in Calgary called the Grand Theater. It was owned by Senator Lougheed, who is the grandfather of Peter Lougheed, who became premier. And the theater still exists. And in 1914, he went to buy a ticket for King Lear. But they wanted to put him in the balcony, and he said, no, I want to sit in the orchestra. And he sued that theater, and he actually won his case. He won $1,000, which was like 20 grand nowadays. And this was 8 years before Lulu Anderson. His case happened the year that Viola Desmond was born, in 1914. But we don't hear about him either. I still haven't been able to find a photo of him, for example. But that article is coming out. But his court case exists,
yeah.
So I'm able to read his words. So that's coming out this weekend, actually. So you can keep an eye out for that. Or there was Ted King, who in 1959, he was refused entry into a Calgary motel. And he sued the motel, but because of how the laws were written, he wasn't protected by the Innskeeper Act because the inn had to serve food, and that hotel didn't serve food. So he lost his case, but a year after, the Alberta legislature closed that loophole. And actually, his son reached out to me. His son saw the blog post I wrote about him. And I'm writing something actually for the Canadian Encyclopedia about Ted King. So we have a long civil rights history in Alberta.
What's the benefit that we can have from moving forward and being more aware of these cases? How can we be more aware of these cases?
Right. I guess what the benefit, like, the first step of solving a problem is by recognizing that there is one. And if in Canada we think we've always been this utopia, Edmonton, so a lot of my, the stuff I do is hyper-focused in Edmonton or in Alberta. And that's because a lot of black history is mostly focused on out east, which is fair because, you know, in Halifax, you know, those communities and everything. And actually there is a colored hockey league. I mentioned this because I signed up for an amateur hockey thing, but there's a colored hockey league like 30, 40 years before the NHL, and that's actually where they pioneered the slap shot and a few other things in hockey. But anyways, if we want to address the problems we have now, a lot of it is from that racist legacy of segregation. When black people first came to Edmonton, there were speeches printed in the Edmonton Journal that said, "We want no dark spots in Alberta." Petitions were circulated opposing black immigration, and city council put a motion forward opposing black immigration. If we look at the legacies of justice, the black incarceration rate in Canada has been the highest since the last 10 years. There's barriers in education, which we've seen in Toronto. They have those stats. And also barriers with policing. So like with carding or racial profiling, for example. The other problem too is we don't really collect racial stats. So like a lot of it's hard to even quantify. But where we have data, it shows there's a gap. And if we don't put that in a context, then we're not ready to fully address the problem.
Thanks, Bashir. I'm going to open it up a bit if anyone has some questions.
Yeah. Hey, Bashir.
Hey.
I have a ton of questions I gave you, but I'm just going to start with one. So, first I want to thank you, because I think what you've done and what you're doing for both Alberta's past and our present is invaluable, and nobody else has that voice but you, and I think you're doing a service, and you're making the province better by doing the research that you're doing, as well as the activism that you do now. So my question is going to be around, let's say, like the John A. McDonald statue in Victoria.
Oh, yeah.
And its removal. Because there's a huge debate, not just here, but around the Western world about how do we memorialize the past, how do we remember the past, how do we think of people who at one point were valorized, but at the same time were also unquestionably guilty of acts that back then and now would be considered objectionable. And I want to just mention one example is that the same question came up in South Africa, where that tension was obviously a lot more visible, you might say, more recent. And there was an MP from a member of parliament in the UK, his name is Kwasi Kwarteng, he's of Ghanaian descent, and he's written a book about the history of the British Empire and all of its sins and its victories or its benefits. And so his response to the idea of taking down all the statues of Cecil Rhodes and all of the other perpetrators of apartheid in South Africa was that we shouldn't necessarily take those statues down, we should surround them with statues of black African heroes and people who did something positive for the country. And taken to the same degree in Canada, could we not also build statues of indigenous people to lionize and to valorize in the same way that John A. McDonald was? And so my question for you then is, your perspective, your opinion, should the John A. McDonald statue in Victoria have been taken down? Should other statues of him be taken down? Or potentially, could we build statues of others whose histories have been marginalized instead?
Yeah, sure. I guess before I start, thank you for the compliment. I was a bit nervous coming up here, but now my ego is like it's to the roof. But yeah, when it comes to the whole monument debate and like Victoria, I guess to put in a context, a lot of people see monuments as history, and to me, like monuments as museums, I think we fail when we do that because monuments are not artifacts of that original time. Like the Victoria's statue, I think that was built in the 80s. Or if you look at things in the US with Confederate statues, a lot of those happened when the Confederate veterans were dying or more recently. So like a lot of those statues were built way after the fact to put their own spin on this history. So when it comes to that statue, I think it should be taken down just based on the history, why it was put up and everything. When it comes to like historic monuments from that era, I think it's important we do keep those, but also place a context around them. So Gibson Block, there's I think one sentence that mentions the white help only sign, but there's no real context around that sign. When it comes to the neighborhood Oliver, it was named after Frank Oliver, who is the immigration policy guy federally back in the day, who limited black immigration. When it comes to those things, well, I guess like in general, every single case I've researched, the people who did the bad thing, they all have monuments named after them. Senator Lougheed, Frank Oliver, you know, all those people, they all have monuments or places named after them. Daniel Knott, he has a school named after him. You went to Daniel?
That was my chair.
Jeez. Did you know about?
I did not know that.
History. Okay. Yeah. If you go to the mayor's office in City Hall, Daniel Knott's portrait is one step outside the mayor's office. So they have all this stuff everywhere, but there's no context. And I think, like, me personally, that's one thing we can do in Edmonton. We can add that context, but then we can also put monuments to the other side. Because Lulu Anderson, no monument. Charles Daniels, no monument. Ted King, no monument. And there's many other civil rights cases. In 1924, you know Borden Park, or the swimming pool? When that original pool was built, it was segregated. And black mothers protested it. And it was this huge saga that lasted for a few months. No reference of that at that pool to this day. So when it comes to, like, monuments, it's case by case. With Victoria, I think we should take that down. But when it comes to, like, stuff in Edmonton, we should put more context around it and also honor our civil rights heroes. And I think that's mentioned at the end of the article. And I guess, like, just to add something quickly, when we think of civil rights in the U.S., we think of the images. We think of fountains that said white fountains, colored fountains. We think of Rosa Parks sitting on the bus. We think of those images. When you think in Canada, we don't see those same images. And that hurts us because we're not able to realize that those cases were real. So any talk I give on this history, I always try to make it local. I always try to say this happened. There's a cross burning at Connors Hill. There was a cross burning at Coliseum. Because then it makes it real. Because those images are out there. The city archives has 1 million photos, but they only have, I think, 70,000 that are available. So these photos do exist, but they're not easily accessible. Yeah, sorry, that was like a big roundabout answer.
One thing Bashir pointed out when we were talking about this talk is just a few blocks from here is the theater that Lulu was refused entrance to. And I think it says something about our history, what we do commemorate and what we don't. And that would be an example of something that could be commemorated for some of these civil rights cases.
Yeah, because there is a plaque there about the theater, but there's no mention of her. No. So,
good cool. Question.
Follow up.
Yeah,
sure.
Sure. It's all right.
We're here.
Okay, so let's take the case of Dan Knott.
Yeah.
It's local. It's present. We know that the KKK supported his election.
Yeah.
But we don't know that he was elected because of the KKK alone.
Right.
Right. So there's always going to be an association with white supremacy, with nasty people who had beliefs that don't. Mm. Line with ours today.
Yeah.
So does that condemn him in that regard?
Right. I think what condemns him is the correspondence. So in 1932, I think, the Klan wanted to have a picnic, which is kind of like, imagine Klan picked. But they wanted to have a picnic. So they sent him a letter, and it's like, "Dear gentlemen, we'd like to hold a picnic August 6 to 8 inclusive, during which a fiery cross will be burnt." And it's like, it's wild. Imagine like having a basket and there's a cross in the, so the fire chief opposed it because a burning thing. And the city engineer wrote, "While not interested in the Klan's or its doings, I must warn you of the hazards." And despite those warnings, he still approved it. And he said, "I hope this is satisfactory to you. Yours truly, Daniel Knott, Mayor." So to me, like, that's the thing which really shows that connection, because the Klan could have campaigned for him and he could have not had, because I can't find anything that says that he campaigned with the Klan. I can only find stuff that says the Klan wanted him elected. But that chain of communication is for me what draws that strong connection between the two. Because a lot of actually, I have 400 pages of KKK documents that I haven't fully gone through. But there's one section where it's like their blackmail list. Anyone who's associated with the Klan before politically. And there's like former premiers on there. Brownlee, you know the Brownlee building? He donated money to the Klan back in the day, and they used this to blackmail him, actually. So yeah, a lot of it too is like, this isn't really well researched. With Daniel Knott, we know that connection, but with other people, we don't have that because for whatever reason, historians haven't looked into it. Actually, remember I gave a Pekka Kucha, like a 6-minute thing, and there was a former historian laureate, and she came up to me after and she said, you did more in 6 minutes about black history than I did in 2 years. And that blew my mind, because I do this on the side. I'm a bureaucrat during the day. So this is what I do on the side. So imagine if someone was like fully paid to like look into all this stuff, we'd have so much more.
On Earth. Well, as a former historian laureate, we weren't paid either. So it,
really? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an honorarium, but that was about it.
Yeah.
I'm kind of torn on the... I'm not a big fan of monuments, period.
Right.
Almost if you put a plaque up, this is what happened here, and maybe add bits of information to
right.
it. But there isn't the perfect person. And I don't care what color they are. You know, this is... So why would you do a statue of a real person? Frank Oliver got the school named after him because he was instrumental in getting education, public education, going in Edmonton. He didn't like people of color. He didn't like Chinese. He didn't like Eastern Europeans. He didn't like anyone who didn't speak English. So there's this whole hate on for Frank Oliver. Probably, you know, anybody who isn't a British subject and white. At that time would have not been a big fan of Frank's. But so it just seems, unless you know that somebody has, you know, is getting their wings and they're going off to whatever, this is, to give them a statue to me just seems overkill.
Right.
And whether, you know, I mean, these people did stuff for some people, they did horrible things to other people.
Right. So when it comes to like, I have flaws, everyone has flaws. But when it comes to like not Frank Oliver, who's the guy on the $5 bill?
Laurier.
Yeah, he wrote an order in council opposing black immigration. Like, there are people that held real political power and they chose to use that in a negative way. While people like Lulu Anderson, Charles Daniels, they didn't hold that political power, but they chose to enter the arena anyways. And, you know, fight for those things. I don't know if Lulu Anderson didn't pick up after her dog or whatever, but the place that Frank Oliver was in, Daniel Knott was in, they had real power and their power had lasting implications. So I think based on that, that's what makes that discussion important. But when it comes to like monuments, I'm not fully saying that we should have a statue of Lulu. Well, A, we don't even know how she looks like. I mean, there's a photo of her in here, but I don't know. Okay, so I'll just explain quickly. So one of my goals was to find a photo of Lulu, but I found a photo of her church, and she's in this photo somewhere. So we don't know how she looks like even. But with public education, youth, I don't think youth learn stuff through monuments or whatever. I think they learn stuff through public education campaigns like heritage minutes. Yeah, like Viola Desmond got a heritage minute last year, and up until a few years ago, she wasn't public knowledge. But because there was a children's book, because there was those cartoons that was written about her, I was giving a speech to this class of elementary students, and I asked them if they knew anything about black history. And this little black girl raised her hand, and she said, Viola Desmond. And it wasn't because of a potential monument to her. It was because of those public education campaigns that told that story. So to answer, like, the other part, there are other ways to honor these cases and the people who went through with these cases.
Thank you. I think, was that a question? Do you have a question? No? Okay. Tim?
Yeah. One of the many things I've done in my life that has not paid off, just made me smarter, is a master's degree.
Right.
So you said master's degree. I talked about Canadian history, right. Canadian studies. I was talking to my prof, and I was like, you know, these guys were racist, oh my god. He's like, yeah, but everyone was racist back then.
Right.
And it brought up something that you mentioned on Twitter, and I wanted to kind of throw a softball out, because I think it answers Sam's question. This idea of presentism, that we can't take today's values and judge the people of the past.
Yeah.
And what I think you said on Twitter was, you know, the people that were getting affected by this always knew it was wrong.
Yeah.
Can you just kind of expand on that? Because I think...
Can I rebut?
No, you had two questions.
Okay. Yeah, like, I think it was... I don't even know what it was in response to. But anyways, it was how... I could find the tweet. My Twitter is like a mix of like, I don't know, making... So my Twitter is a mix of like roasting pundits and like memes. But then I realized after I got published in the Globe and Mail that I'm a pundit now. So I have to balance that line. But the tweet was like talking about how when people say we shouldn't consider... we shouldn't apply modern day morals on the past. When we look at the past, enslaved people always knew that being a slave was wrong. If you were segregated from a bar, you knew that was wrong. Actually, in 1910, I don't know what the bar name was, but there's a news article about black Edmontonians going bar to bar and protesting their segregation. So they knew it was wrong then. When it comes to people being referred by the N-word in their first name, when John Ware was called the N-word, there's one case where I was reading an interview by his daughter, and he was in a bar, and he punched the guy, and he paid that guy's hospital bill. So people who were oppressed always knew that it was wrong. So, and I think that also just comes from an ignorance of history. Because if you look at news articles from back then, it's really interesting how much that applies nowadays, like to modern debates around whatever. And I really encourage you, go on a Google Peel Prairie Archive. You can search by any topic, and you can find just really old articles. And yeah, it's just interesting because humans haven't really changed. And yeah.
And I think that speaks to, I know it's a bit of a dead horse, but the Oliver issue. Right. I think it speaks to when we have monuments and things named after Oliver, it speaks to that he was powerful at the time. Right. And the power structure of the time supported him. But I don't think his victims thought he was in the right. And I don't think his victims thought limiting black immigration, opposing Eastern European immigration, taking land from a lot of the indigenous groups around Edmonton was a good thing at that time. Right. He was memorized because the political structures that he controlled enjoyed that influence. Right. And I think that's what a lot of our monuments speak to. It speaks to power at the time, not necessarily what people thought was right.
Yeah, and like how it's interpreted, like the Confederate monuments, a lot of those are like, some of those are built like 100 years after the war. And it was built to push that revisionist history. So whenever you see a monument, if they have like a date stamp, see when it was built, because it also reflects on how that person was viewed in that time, or like even nowadays. Because people still refuse to really acknowledge what John A. Macdonald did was wrong, or you know, whoever did was wrong. Actually, a lot of people who live in Oliver probably don't know who Frank Oliver is. Yeah.
Cool. One more question, then everyone wants to get back to the DJ and the food.
All right.
Luam.
On the side. Sorry, guys. Can you hear me?
Oh.
I'm in this corner. No, I can just speak.
Okay.
I think just my comment is that about the statues already there, before we even can discuss like whether they should be taken down or not, I think there's this idea that there's this misinformation happening, or the story of John A. Macdonald or Oliver, Frank Oliver is not complete. It's not in the way it's originally when the name was given and so on. The history they were trying, the story they were trying to give to the public was very one-sided. Mm. And so I think before we can even discuss what we should do with these monuments is first acknowledge that we don't have context, we don't have the full story about these people. And you are right, a lot of people, I didn't know who Frank Oliver was or what he did when I moved in, and it wasn't until, when people brought it to my attention and I read on it and so on that I knew, I kind of feel like I know a little bit more about him, the person, not the persona that these, that later generation brought on. And so I think the question should be like, how are we going to educate the public? Where does that start? Is it the school to say, okay, of course John A. Macdonald did some good things, but here's other things he did that probably are wrong. And so now we have to deal with the consequences of his actions, and how are we going to move forward having these statues trying to tell us a very one-sided kind of half-truth. Now that we have the complete story, what's the next step? But I don't think we can discuss that until we first acknowledge that we don't have the full truth, and the majority of the public doesn't know who he really was and what he really did and what these issues are.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I guess, like, to talk about getting that context, to give an example, it's like my first time in an archive was really weird. I thought you had to pay to go to an archive, but, like, they're government-run, so they're free. But when I showed up there, they actually asked me if I was lost, which blew my mind. Which, like, I don't know, like, I was out of place. Like, a lot of the staff were older white people. A lot of the people researching stuff were older white people. So I was very out of place, and they kept, like, making sure that I didn't mess up the documents or anything. And, like, that really blew my mind, like, just those barriers of, you know, facing that suspicion, but also them not understanding my research question. The furthest I got was only because there was one archivist I met. Her name is Robin Wallace, and she's Métis. So when I was talking to her about, like, I was interested in this history, she started talking about how, you know, she's from out east, and, like, how Louis Riel is remembered, and how his history was written by, you know, the people who oppressed the Métis. So, like, I had a strong connection with her, and I still do. Anytime I have a research question, I go to her. But if she wasn't there, then I probably honestly would have given up. So with these figures and everything, contemporary historians, I think, don't really challenge Oliver, Daniel Knott, Senator Lougheed, because, in my opinion, they may not see those things as issues, or they may not see them as that big of a problem. So that's why this stuff hasn't really been written about, even though it's been in the archives. That's why it hasn't been written about. So, what we need to do is learn about this. So we need to, I do this on my free time. So we need to, like, pay someone. We need to pay archivists. We need to digitize these records. We need to get this stuff out there, because, I mean, well, you boosted my ego, so I was going to, okay, but, like, this article's one step, but, and there's a few other people, like Cheryl Fogo and a few other historians, like Minister Faust, for example, who are doing similar work, but they're not a tenured history prof. So maybe that's just something to think about. I don't know if you guys are academics, but, one final thing. One final thing. I always try to keep my stuff really accessible. That's why I post on Twitter a lot, and I have my website and everything. So I always try to keep it hyper accessible, simple language, because when I was in university, I took this course on poverty, and the textbook was $200, which, like, blew my mind. Or if I want to read an academic article about racism, it's like $80 to access that journal. So a lot of this, too, is, like, hidden there, because, like, some of the guides I found were, like, in journals that were behind paywalls, and because I'm not a university student anymore, I'd, like, text my friend and be like, hey, can you pull this or whatever? So, yeah, just keep that in mind. Like, who's in charge of this history? How is it accessible, and what can we do to make it easier to find out about our city?
Thanks, Bashir. I just want to encourage everybody to stick around and continue to talk amongst yourselves afterwards.
Yeah, I'll be here all night.
We'll be here all night. Please approach Bashir with your questions. I'm sure he'd love to chat with you after. And please enjoy the issue. I hope that you can learn something more about your community. I definitely did, reading Bashir's article and some of the other really good articles we have in this issue. Thank you.
And thank you to Yard's publisher, Simon Yakalik, for hosting this conversation with Edmonton writer and historian Bashir Muhammad. Follow him on Twitter if you aren't already, at Bashir Muhammad. Thanks to the team at the Yards for their help in this podcast partnership, and Andrew Williams for technical support. The conversation continues at theyardsyeg.ca, where you can check out the new issue and past stories, and at downtown and all of our businesses listed at theyardsyeg.ca, where you can find a copy of the magazine published four times each year. Thanks for listening to this podcast, a partnership of two of Edmonton's local journalism publishers, The Yards and Edmonton Quotient. You can find more stories, podcasts, and community items at theyardsyeg.ca and edmontonquotient.com. I'm Jeff Samsonow. Thank you for being part of the conversation.